A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hey, Herman and Corin. We talked in a previous episode about how I am tapering off a sleep medicine called Seroquel, or rather a drug called Seroquel, which is used in low dosages off-label for sleep. And I have to say that was a really, really interesting episode because we touched upon sleep architecture, how chemical sleep is not the same thing. And it's given me extra motivation to really attempt to power through the end of it. I've made some small improvements so far in my circadian rhythm, you'll be pleased to hear. I do really find that dimming the lights at the end of the day, I've been getting into Home Assistant again just for that, really makes a big difference, and setting up a nice bedtime routine, and it helps. There is some progress. What I'd love to talk about today is a question about pharmacology. You know that I take a drug called Vyvanse also for ADHD, and this is a drug that I feel much more favorable about compared to Seroquel. I've tried the non-stimulants and really found that Vyvanse, for all its, sometimes challenges in access, and, you know, no drug is perfect, but overall I find it gives me a reliable, steady state of functionality and makes managing life with ADHD much more effective. But something that I've noticed or thought about is that when I was learning about what Seroquel does, it's this kind of, it's an older drug that has a lot of different, hits a lot of different receptor sites, but part of its mechanism of action, if I'm not mistaken, is having a dampening effect on dopamine. And if we look at the where Seroquel is used in its conventional format in those high dosages, along with the antipsychotics, these are drugs that dampen dopamine in patients who are schizophrenic and very different scenario. But that's, if I understand correctly, broadly speaking, that is its mechanism of action, or the kind of common profile across these drugs. And what's interesting to me, or what got me thinking, is that we talked about how Seroquel has a surprisingly long half-life. The metabolite sticks around for 12 hours even with instant release, which means that if you do take it for bed, unless you're actually fully off the drug, there's always going to be a bit of it hanging around your bloodstream, because it takes 5 half-lives to clear a drug from the bloodstream almost completely. You see, I'm full of you thought Herman was the guy with all the facts. I have a few of them myself, but the question I have for you is, how does that actually work when you have two drugs colliding with totally opposing mechanisms of action? I don't believe there's any, contraindication, at least in my case, for these two drugs, because I take them, both were prescribed. But one is dampening down your dopamine, the other is bringing it up, or stimulating dopamine release. And for a certain period of time each day, I always kind of picture it that there's these two boxers in my head, and Vyvanse is starting to knock back Seroquel, who eventually, about a few hours later, gets defeated. But it really seems to me as if that it doesn't. I mean, coming at it from a non-medical standpoint, it doesn't sound like such a good idea that you should have these two things going against one another. The only thing there's probably a lot of drug pairings we can look at in recreational and illicit use that might have these opposing mechanisms of action. There was, I recall, a big controversy. I remember when I went to the US, I did a J-1 summer visa many years ago, and these alcoholic drinks that were like these mashups of energy drinks and quite strong alcohol, like 8% ABV, these were kind of all the rage, and they had some very startling effects on those who consumed them. They were not recommended, and I think after a while they actually got regulated. But let's talk about how that works exactly in pharmacological terms. Is it something that is best avoided? And what does it actually look like when you have two things that are kind of at war with one another for control over the same drug receptor?
Daniel sent us this one, and I have to say, it's a genuinely interesting pharmacological puzzle. He's been tapering off Seroquel, the sleep med we talked about before, and he's also on Vyvanse for ADH. And he noticed something. Seroquel dampens dopamine, Vyvanse boosts it. His question is basically, what happens when you've got two drugs with opposing mechanisms of action colliding in your system every day? Is this a pharmacological boxing match? And should we be worried about it?
He's not wrong to ask. This is one of those questions where the intuitive answer, two opposing forces canceling out, doesn't quite capture what's actually happening at the receptor level. Also, quick note, DeepSeek V4 Pro is writing our script today, so if anything comes out especially lucid, that's why.
I was wondering why you hadn't quoted a paper yet. Give it time.
It's coming. But let's start with the setup, because Daniel's framing is actually quite precise. He described it as two boxers in his head, with Vyvanse eventually knocking out Seroquel a few hours later. That's vivid, and it gets at something real, but the actual pharmacology is weirder and more interesting than a straight fight. The first thing to understand is that these two drugs aren't really fighting over the same territory in the way Daniel's metaphor suggests. They're operating on the same neurotransmitter system, dopamine, but at different receptors with different affinities, different time courses, and in different brain regions. It's less like two boxers in one ring and more like two construction crews working on different floors of the same building, sometimes at cross purposes, but not directly wrestling each other.
The boxing metaphor is vivid but misleading.
It's a good starting point, but let's unpack it. Seroquel, or quetiapine, is what pharmacologists call a dirty drug, and I don't mean that pejoratively, I mean it hits a lot of targets. At low doses, like the 25 to 50 milligrams Daniel was taking for sleep, its primary action is actually not on dopamine at all. It's a potent histamine H1 receptor antagonist. That's what knocks you out. The sedation from low-dose Seroquel is overwhelmingly a histamine blockade effect, not a dopamine effect.
Wait, so the sleep effect isn't even coming from the dopamine dampening?
At low doses, barely. Quetiapine's affinity for the histamine H1 receptor is something like 50 times stronger than its affinity for dopamine D2 receptors. At 25 or 50 milligrams, you're getting massive histamine blockade and only something like 10 to 20% D2 receptor occupancy. The dopamine dampening at those doses is actually quite modest.
That's already complicating the boxing match picture. So if Daniel's on a low dose for sleep, the dopamine antagonism might be less significant than he thinks.
Right, but it's not zero, and this is where the half-life point he raised becomes important. He mentioned the norketiapine metabolite sticking around for about 12 hours, and he's correct. Quetiapine itself has a half-life of about 7 hours, but its active metabolite norketiapine hangs around longer. After 5 half-lives for full clearance, you're looking at residual drug in the system for well over a day. So even if the D2 blockade is modest at low doses, there is some degree of dopamine receptor antagonism present into the next morning, exactly when he's taking his Vyvanse.
Vyvanse is doing what exactly?
Lisdexamfetamine is a prodrug. It's inactive until it's metabolized in the bloodstream, cleaving off the lysine molecule and gradually releasing dextroamphetamine. That dextroamphetamine then acts as a substrate for the dopamine transporter and the norepinephrine transporter, and it also enters presynaptic vesicles through VMAT2, displacing dopamine and norepinephrine into the cytoplasm, which then get pumped out into the synapse through reverse transport. The net effect is a sustained increase in synaptic dopamine and norepinephrine.
Vyvanse is flooding the synapse with more dopamine, and Seroquel is blocking some of the receptors that dopamine would bind to.
That's the apparent contradiction, yes. But here's where it gets nuanced. Seroquel, even at higher doses, is what's called a loose binder at the D2 receptor. It binds and unbinds rapidly. That's actually one of the reasons it's less likely to cause the severe movement disorders you see with older antipsychotics like haloperidol, which clamp onto D2 like a barnacle. Quetiapine's fast dissociation means endogenous dopamine can still compete with it. So when Vyvanse increases synaptic dopamine, that dopamine can actually displace quetiapine from some of those D2 receptors.
The stimulant can win, in a sense, simply by raising the concentration of the natural ligand high enough to outcompete the blocker.
This is competitive antagonism in action. Quetiapine isn't irreversibly disabling the receptor, it's just occupying it temporarily. If you raise the concentration of dopamine high enough, dopamine wins the competition for binding sites. This is fundamentally different from what would happen if you had an irreversible antagonist or something that downregulated the receptors entirely.
The boxing match is more like a queue at a coffee shop. Seroquel is standing in line at the D2 receptor, but if enough dopamine shows up, it pushes past.
That's actually a better metaphor. And the concentration of dopamine that Vyvanse produces in the striatum and prefrontal cortex is substantial. We're talking about extracellular dopamine levels increasing by several 100% above baseline in key regions. At low-dose quetiapine with its modest D2 occupancy, that dopamine surge is going to functionally override much of the blockade during Vyvanse's active window.
Daniel's intuition that Vyvanse eventually knocks out Seroquel is directionally correct, but it's not happening hours later. It's happening within the first hour or two of Vyvanse taking effect, and it's not a knockout so much as a crowd out.
And this gets to a broader pharmacological principle. When you have an agonist or a releaser like amphetamine paired with an antagonist like quetiapine, the net effect depends on their relative concentrations, their binding affinities, and the receptor reserve in that particular brain region. If there are spare receptors, and there usually are, the agonist can often produce its full effect even in the presence of a modest antagonist concentration.
Receptor reserve. Explain that.
Many receptor systems in the brain have more receptors than are needed for a maximal response. You might only need to activate, say, 10% of the available D2 receptors in the striatum to get a full functional effect. If quetiapine is occupying 20% of them, there are still 80% available, which is way more than enough. The system has built-in redundancy, so even if quetiapine is sitting on some receptors, Vyvanse can still produce its full therapeutic effect through the unoccupied ones.
That's actually reassuring. So the concern that these two drugs are canceling each other out is probably overblown.
For the stimulant effect, yes. But there's another side to this. What about the Seroquel side of the equation? Daniel's taking it for sleep. If Vyvanse is increasing dopamine and norepinephrine, could that be interfering with the sedative effect of Seroquel at bedtime?
That seems like the more practical concern. Not whether Vyvanse works during the day, but whether the Seroquel still works at night.
This is where the pharmacokinetics matter. Vyvanse is designed to provide about 12 to 14 hours of coverage. If Daniel takes it at, say, 7 in the morning, by 9 or 10 at night, the dextroamphetamine levels are declining substantially. But they're not zero. The terminal half-life of dextroamphetamine is around 10 to 12 hours, so at bedtime there's still maybe 20 to 30% of the peak concentration circulating.
Which could be enough to make falling asleep harder, even with the Seroquel.
But remember, Seroquel's sleep effect at low doses is mainly histamine H1 blockade, not dopamine blockade. Histamine is a major wakefulness, promoting neurotransmitter, and blocking H1 receptors is powerfully sedating regardless of what dopamine is doing. That's why antihistamines like Benadryl make you drowsy, same mechanism. So Vyvanse's residual dopamine elevation at bedtime doesn't directly counteract histamine blockade.
Anecdotally, plenty of people on stimulants report sleep difficulties, so something's going on.
Vyvanse increases norepinephrine too, and norepinephrine is a key arousal neurotransmitter. The locus coeruleus, which is the brain's main source of norepinephrine, is intimately involved in maintaining wakefulness. Even if the histamine system is suppressed by Seroquel, elevated norepinephrine from residual amphetamine can still promote arousal. It's a different pathway.
We've got histamine blocked, dopamine partially blocked, but norepinephrine still elevated. That's a mixed signal for the sleep systems.
And this is why Daniel's approach of dimming lights and building a bedtime routine is actually smart pharmacology. Those behavioral interventions are helping to suppress norepinephrine and promote melatonin release through the circadian system. He's effectively adding another push towards sleep from a different angle, compensating for the residual stimulant effect.
That's a nice connection, but let me pull on a thread Daniel mentioned. He brought up those energy drink and alcohol combos from years ago, the ones that got regulated. Is that a parallel here?
It's an interesting comparison, but it's different mechanistically. The Four Loko phenomenon, and that's what he's referring to, those caffeinated alcoholic beverages that were all over the news around 2010. That was about combining a stimulant with a depressant that both act broadly. Caffeine is an adenosine antagonist that promotes wakefulness, and alcohol is a GABA agonist that promotes sedation and disinhibition. The danger there was that the caffeine masked the subjective feeling of intoxication, so people didn't realize how impaired they were and kept drinking.
It wasn't about the drugs canceling each other pharmacologically. It was about one drug masking the perceptual cues of the other.
The alcohol was still impairing motor coordination and judgment. The caffeine just made people feel less drunk than they actually were. That's a perceptual interaction, not a receptor-level cancellation. The FDA actually sent warning letters to several manufacturers in 2010, and by the end of that year, these products were effectively removed from the market.
With Vyvanse and Seroquel, is there any masking effect? Could the Seroquel be masking some of the Vyvanse side effects, or vice versa?
There's a known clinical phenomenon where low-dose quetiapine is sometimes used off-label to help with stimulant-induced insomnia or anxiety. The histamine blockade and the modest alpha-1 adrenergic blockade can take the edge off some of the physical overstimulation that stimulants can cause. Some clinicians actually see this combination as complementary rather than contradictory.
What Daniel characterizes as two boxers fighting might actually be, from a certain clinical perspective, a functional partnership. The Seroquel softens the Vyvanse's rough edges at night, and the Vyvanse overrides the Seroquel's dopamine dampening during the day.
That's the optimistic view, and there's some logic to it. But let's talk about the less optimistic view, because Daniel asked whether this is something that's best avoided. Are there real concerns with combining a dopamine antagonist and a dopamine releaser chronically?
I'd want to know about receptor regulation. If you're constantly pushing dopamine up with Vyvanse and then partially blocking receptors with Seroquel, what does the brain do over time?
This is where we get into the weeds of receptor upregulation and downregulation, and the picture isn't entirely clear. Chronic antagonism of D2 receptors typically leads to upregulation. The brain makes more receptors to compensate for the blockade. Chronic agonism or increased dopamine signaling typically leads to downregulation. If you're doing both simultaneously, it's hard to predict the net effect, and it likely varies by brain region.
You could theoretically be sending contradictory adaptive signals to the dopamine system.
But here's the thing. At the low doses of Seroquel used for sleep, the D2 occupancy is so modest that the upregulation signal is probably quite weak. Meanwhile, Vyvanse is producing substantial dopamine elevations during the day, which would tend to promote downregulation. The net effect might just be a slight blunting of the stimulant's efficacy over time. But this is speculative. There aren't large randomized trials looking at this specific combination long term.
That's one of those things where clinical practice runs ahead of the evidence. People are prescribed this combination. It seems to work for many of them. But the detailed receptor biology of what's happening over years hasn't been rigorously studied.
And this connects to a broader point about polypharmacy in psychiatry. It's very common, it's often necessary, but the evidence base for specific combinations is usually thin. Clinicians are making judgments based on mechanism, clinical experience, and patient report. Daniel's combination isn't unusual. Quetiapine plus a stimulant is actually a fairly common pairing, especially in people who have both ADH and sleep difficulties or mood instability.
Let me ask about the dopamine dampening at higher doses, because Daniel mentioned schizophrenia. Seroquel at 300 to 800 milligrams is a different beast than at 25 milligrams.
At antipsychotic doses, quetiapine achieves 60 to 80% D2 receptor occupancy, which is the threshold for therapeutic antipsychotic effect. At those doses, you'd expect much more significant interference with the stimulant's dopamine effects. But that's not Daniel's situation. At his sleep dose, we're looking at maybe 10 to 20% occupancy, clinically significant for some mild mood stabilization effects, but not enough to seriously blunt a stimulant.
The dose makes the interaction. Low-dose Seroquel and Vyvanse isn't the same pharmacological situation as high-dose Seroquel and Vyvanse.
And this is a point that often gets lost when people talk about drug interactions. They think of it as drug A plus, drug B equals interaction C. But it's really drug A at dose X plus, drug B at dose Y at time Z after dosing in a specific individual with specific genetics. The interaction is a moving target.
Speaking of time, Daniel mentioned the half-life point with some pride. You thought Herman was the guy with all the facts. I think he enjoyed that.
He did get that right, and I'm pleased. He's correct that it takes about 5 half-lives to clear a drug from the bloodstream almost completely. For quetiapine, with its 7-hour half-life, that's about 35 hours. For norketiapine, with its 12-hour half-life, that's about 60 hours, or 2.5 days. So even with instant release Soraquel taken only at night, there's always some drug in the system.
Which means the dopamine receptors are never fully free of antagonism. Even during the day, when Vyvanse is at peak effect, there's a low level of Seroquel still occupying some receptors.
But again, the concentration matters. By the next afternoon, the residual quetiapine level is a fraction of the peak, and its D2 occupancy is correspondingly lower. At that point, the Vyvanse-driven dopamine elevation is dominating the system. The Seroquel is present, but functionally outgunned.
Daniel's boxing metaphor isn't entirely wrong, but the knockout happens much earlier in the day than he pictures, and it's not a dramatic event. It's just a gradual shift in which drug's concentration is driving the net effect.
There's another layer here that's worth mentioning. Vyvanse doesn't just increase dopamine, it also changes the pattern of dopamine release. Dopamine neurons have two modes of firing, tonic, which is a steady background level, and phasic, which is burst firing in response to salient stimuli. Amphetamines tend to increase tonic dopamine, which can actually reduce phasic dopamine responses by activating presynaptic autoreceptors that inhibit further release.
Vyvanse is raising the baseline, but potentially blunting the peaks?
In some brain regions, yes. And quetiapine, by blocking some D2 receptors, might actually be preserving some phasic signaling by preventing those autoreceptors from being overstimulated. This is speculative, but it's possible that the combination, at these doses, actually produces a more functional dopamine signaling profile than either drug alone would.
That's a counterintuitive possibility, that the apparent opposition is actually producing a better net outcome.
Pharmacology is full of counterintuitive outcomes like that. It's why you can't just look at two mechanisms and predict the clinical effect. You have to look at the actual outcomes in actual patients. And for this combination, the clinical experience, and I say this as a retired pediatrician who's seen these medications used, is that many patients do well on it.
Let me bring up something Daniel didn't mention, but that's relevant here. Seroquel's metabolite, norquetiapine, is actually a norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor. It has some antidepressant effects that are thought to be mediated through norepinephrine. So while quetiapine is blocking dopamine receptors, its metabolite is boosting norepinephrine.
Norquetiapine is a potent norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor, and it's the main circulating metabolite. So Daniel's Seroquel dose is actually producing a sustained norepinephrine boost from the metabolite alongside the dopamine blockade from the parent drug, and Vyvanse is also boosting norepinephrine. So on the norepinephrine side, these drugs might actually be synergistic, not antagonistic.
Which could explain why some people feel more activated on this combination than you'd expect if you just thought of Seroquel as a sedating dopamine blocker.
The pharmacology of quetiapine is complex. At low doses, it's an antihistamine that sedates. At moderate doses, it adds serotonin receptor blockade and some mood effects. At high doses, it's a dopamine antagonist antipsychotic. And throughout, the norquetiapine metabolite is providing a norepinephrine and serotonin reuptake inhibition effect. It's like three different drugs stapled together, and the dose determines which profile dominates.
When Daniel asks whether having two drugs with opposing mechanisms is something to avoid, the answer is, it depends on which mechanisms you're looking at what doses, and in which brain systems.
What the clinical outcome actually is. If Daniel is sleeping well, functioning well during the day, and not experiencing significant side effects, then the combination is working for him regardless of what the mechanism diagram looks like on paper. The proof is in the patient, not the receptor chart.
That said, there are legitimate concerns with long-term use of either medication. Vyvanse has cardiovascular considerations, potential for tolerance, effects on appetite and sleep architecture. Seroquel, even at low doses, has metabolic effects, weight gain, insulin resistance, lipid changes. These aren't trivial.
No, they're not. Quetiapine's metabolic side effects are well documented and they occur even at low doses. The histamine H1 blockade that makes it sedating also promotes appetite and weight gain. And there are case reports of significant weight gain and metabolic syndrome even at 25 to 50 milligrams for sleep. It's one of the reasons the guidelines generally recommend against using quetiapine as a first-line sleep aid. The metabolic risk is real and accumulates over time.
Which is why Daniel's tapering effort makes sense from a long-term health perspective, beyond just the pharmacological curiosity about receptor interactions.
Getting off chronic Seroquel for sleep is a reasonable goal, especially if behavioral approaches like the light management and bedtime routine he mentioned are working. The best sleep aid, in the long run, is a well-entrained circadian rhythm and good sleep hygiene. Everything else is a temporary bridge.
Yet for someone with ADH, D who needs the Vyvanse to function during the day and struggles with sleep, partly because ADHDD. Itself is associated with circadian rhythm disruptions and sleep disorders. Having a pharmacological option for sleep isn't unreasonable. It's about risk-benefit trade-offs.
ADH. HD is associated with a higher prevalence of delayed sleep phase disorder, restless leg syndrome, and general insomnia. The stimulant medications can exacerbate those, but untreated, ADHD also disrupts sleep. It's a complex picture. Sometimes you need a sleep medication to make the ADHD treatment sustainable. The question is, which sleep medication, at what dose, for how long, and with what monitoring?
To synthesize what we've been saying, Daniel's boxing match picture captures something real, but it's messier and more interesting than a straight fight. The two drugs are operating on overlapping but not identical systems, at different times, with different binding characteristics. The net effect during the day is probably dominated by Vyvanse. The net effect at night is probably dominated by Seroquel's histamine blockade, plus whatever behavioral and circadian support he's adding. And the long-term receptor adaptation picture is uncertain.
That's a fair summary. And I'd add that the combination isn't inherently dangerous or irrational. It's pharmacologically complex, it's not ideal for everyone, but for many patients it works. The fact that two drugs push in different directions on paper doesn't mean they cancel out or cause harm. The body isn't a simple balance scale.
One more thing I want to touch on. Daniel mentioned the recreational and illicit use parallels, drugs with opposing mechanisms. I think he was gesturing towards speedballs, the classic combination of a stimulant and a depressant.
The speedball, typically cocaine and heroin, or amphetamine and an opioid, is a different beast entirely. That combination is dangerous, not because the drugs cancel each other out, but because they create a push-pull on the cardiovascular and respiratory systems that can be lethal. The stimulant increases heart rate and oxygen demand. The opioid depresses respiration. You can end up with a situation where the stimulant wears off first, leaving the opioid to cause respiratory arrest.
That's not a receptor competition issue. It's a systems-level conflict between two drugs acting on entirely different pathways that both affect vital functions.
The Vyvanse-Seroquel combination doesn't pose that kind of acute danger. Seroquel isn't a respiratory depressant in the way opioids are, and Vyvanse's cardiovascular effects are generally manageable in healthy individuals. The concerns with Daniel's combination are more about long-term metabolic health and the question of whether chronic dopamine system perturbation has subtle effects over years. Those are real concerns, but they're not the same category of risk as a speedball.
The energy drink and alcohol parallel is closer in spirit, but even that's different because the danger there was behavioral, people doing dangerous things because they didn't feel drunk, rather than a direct pharmacological conflict.
And the regulatory response to those caffeinated alcoholic beverages is actually an interesting case study in how we think about drug interactions. The FD. A's concern wasn't that caffeine and alcohol had a dangerous chemical interaction. It was that the combination created a product that was unsafe in practice because it altered behavior in a risky way. The pharmacology was fine on paper. The public health outcome was not.
Which is a reminder that drug interactions aren't just about receptor binding. They're about what actually happens when real people take these things in real-world conditions.
That's the ultimate answer to Daniel's question. On paper, these two drugs push dopamine in opposite directions. In practice, at the doses he's taking, the clinical effect is probably that Vyvanse works during the day and Seroquel helps with sleep at night, and the overlap is managed by the pharmacokinetics and the receptor dynamics we've been describing. It's not a boxing match. It's more like a shift change at a factory, where the night crew and the day crew overlap for a bit, but mostly do their jobs in sequence.
That's a good image, and the long-term question of whether this combination is optimal is really a question about whether the factory runs better with the night crew or without it. If Daniel can taper off the Seroquel and manage his sleep through behavioral and circadian interventions, that's probably a win for his long-term metabolic health. But if he needs it to sustain his ADHD treatment and his quality of life, the combination isn't pharmacologically irrational.
One last point on the dopamine question specifically. There's actually a fascinating literature on the interaction between sleep and dopamine. Dopamine D2 receptors are involved in regulating the sleep-wake cycle. Dopamine promotes wakefulness, that's well established. But dopamine also plays a role in sleep consolidation and in the transition between sleep stages. So the relationship isn't as simple as more dopamine equals less sleep. The timing and the brain region matter enormously.
Which means that even if Seroquel's dopamine blockade is modest at low doses, it might be doing something useful for sleep architecture beyond just the histamine sedation.
There's some evidence that quetiapine increases slow-wave sleep, which is the deep, restorative stage of sleep. That might be mediated through serotonin receptor blockade or through some other mechanism. The point is, sleep pharmacology is complicated, and a drug that helps you fall asleep isn't necessarily giving you good quality sleep.
That was one of the key points from the earlier discussion, that chemical sleep isn't the same as natural sleep. The architecture is different.
And that's why Daniel's tapering effort is worthwhile. Getting to natural, behaviorally supported sleep is the goal. The Seroquel was a bridge, and if he's making progress on the behavioral side, he's moving in the right direction.
To directly answer Daniel's question, is this combination something that's best avoided? At the doses involved, the dopamine antagonism from low-dose Seroquel is modest and partially overridden by Vyvanse during the day. The combination isn't pharmacologically irrational, and many patients use it successfully. But the long-term metabolic risks of Seroquel are real, and transitioning away from it is a reasonable goal if sustainable.
The broader lesson is that opposing mechanisms don't automatically mean a bad combination. The body has multiple systems with multiple receptors, and drugs that push in opposite directions on paper can sometimes produce a more balanced net effect than either drug alone. Pharmacology is messy, and clinical outcomes matter more than mechanism diagrams.
One thing Daniel might find reassuring, his image of Seroquel being defeated a few hours into the day is actually a pretty good intuitive model of what happens. The stimulant's dopamine elevation outcompetes the residual antagonist, and by mid-morning, the Vyvanse is running the show. The Seroquel's main job, histamine blockade for sleep, is done by then anyway.
He should keep doing the light management and bedtime routine. That stuff is real pharmacology too, just endogenously mediated. Dimming lights promotes melatonin release, which feeds into the circadian system, which regulates sleep pressure. He's effectively adding his own endogenous sleep drug to the mix, and that's going to make the Seroquel taper easier.
All right, I think we've given Daniel a thorough answer. Complex pharmacology, counterintuitive interactions, and a verdict that his combination isn't as contradictory as it looks on paper.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1980s, researchers in Belize measured the altitude of a Type B aurora and found the red fringe topped out at 290 kilometers, which is about 40 kilometers lower than modern satellite measurements suggest for the same emission layer today.
40 kilometers is a non-trivial discrepancy.
I have no idea what to do with that information.
So to wrap up, Daniel, tapering is going well, keep at the behavioral interventions, and your two boxes are more like co-workers on different shifts than mortal enemies. If you're feeling good and functioning well, the combination is doing its job.
If anyone listening wants to dig deeper into the Vyvanse side of things, the sleep architecture discussion, or the ADHD medication landscape, you can find more at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. This has been My Weird Props. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. We'll catch you next time.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Props, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.